Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
What a sight from the ground cameras at Stargate. We're flying at twice the thrust of the Saturn V heading to space.
Hello and welcome to Space Boffins, fashionably late since 2011. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientists and I'm Richard Hollingham.
I'm Sue Nelson. And this time we'll hear from the European Space Agency's Director of Human and Robotic Exploration, David Parker, about their latest class of astronaut recruits and NASA's Bill Hartwell on working with ESA on the Artemis missions to the moon.
This is the first time that NASA has ever entrusted a core element of our flagship spacecraft, human-rated spacecraft, to an international partner. You don't make a commitment to a partnership like that lightly.
Our first guest is distinguished Irish science and space broadcaster Leo Enright, who's been covering space for most of his career. Apologies, that just makes you sound old, doesn't it?
Well, I'm laughing. Distinguished. I think you exaggerate somewhat.
Oh, no, you absolutely. You've got a Wikipedia page and everything.
What's interesting, Leo, is that although many people will know you from your space broadcasting, is that you've also been a Middle Eastern correspondent. I knew you were news correspondent, but I just thought, my goodness, you've been around a bit.
Well, I've been around the houses, Sue, but you're much younger than me, so I can understand why you're struck by my quote unquote CV. Yeah, I have interviewed kings, presidents, despots. I've covered wars, on three continents, and all people seem to want to ask me about is outer space. I mean, I just can't understand that.
But you can really, because I was amazed to discover that you've basically been a commentator on every major space event since the 1960s, and that you'd actually began commentating as a schoolboy. What was that? Was that in your room for like Radio Leo?
Well, no, actually, it was from Cape Canaveral. I was a kid, and I was fascinated by space, as most kids of my generation were. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s, and so I was determined to see a moonshot. So I worked on summer jobs in Dublin for a couple of years as a teenager. I saved up all my pocket money, and my father, God rest him, was prepared to offer me matching funds, as it were. So if I put together enough money myself, he'd contribute for me to go to the last Apollo mission to the moon. That was Apollo 17. So I was a snotty-nosed 17-year-old. On a journey through America. I actually flew into Kennedy in New York and took the bus because I couldn't afford anything else. I took the Greyhound bus down to Florida for the launch. And then I took a Greyhound bus after the launch from the Cape over to Houston, which took the best part of 3 days. So it took me as long to get from the Cape to Mission Control in Houston as it took the Apollo 17 astronauts to get to the moon.
You actually got in and got to see the launch.
Oh, yes, I was at the Cape at the press site, and I believe I still hold the record as the youngest accredited foreign correspondent of, you know, in America. That's my claim, and I believe I'm, you know, open to correction, but until somebody comes forward to challenge it, that's my claim.
That is extraordinary. So who heard or who read what you produced from there?
Well, I was working for two people, really. I was working for the Irish Independent, which is still publishing. It was they, in fact, who gave me the credentials. Bill Shine, who was a tremendous news editor, absolutely legendary figure in the Irish Independent. Bill Shine lived up the road from me. And, you know, that's how things are done in Ireland. It's still the case, you know, if you know somebody. So Bill wrote me a letter of credence. So I wrote for them. But I also did television for RTE. And that was interesting because, of course, that was long before satellite communications, transatlantic communications. So what happened was they were roving around the press site, the American Information Service, the American State Department's press office, as it were, had a camera crew who wandered around the press site looking for reporters who couldn't afford a camera person. And so they stood me up with the rocket behind me, and I did a piece to camera. They put it this was film, not video. This is long before videotape. They put the video into a can, the film into a can, and they air freighted it back to RTE. So it was broadcast a couple of days later. You know, it came in on the Aer Lingus flight overnight from New York. So that's how I did my first TV broadcast.
That's an extraordinary story. I mean, what was it like, you know, rubbing shoulders with these legends of American broadcasting, like, you know, Walter Cronkite and these, you know, particularly with this, you know, the history around Apollo 17 being the last crewed mission to the moon?
Well, it was deeply embarrassing, Richard. It's all I can say. I presume you read somewhere the backstory to this, because I think that's the only reason you would ask this question. I was at the Time Life party. A moon launch was a bit like the Oscars. Everybody was there. I seem to remember talking to Paul Newman at the Time Life party. And everybody was there. It was just amazing. And for a kid of 17 from Ireland to be in the middle of all of this was just literally, you know, you can picture it if you imagine somebody being at the Oscars parties. This was exactly what this felt like. And somebody said, why don't you meet Walter Cronkite? The legendary Walter Cronkite. And I said to them, oh, well, okay, I've met everybody else. I might as well meet Walter Cronkite. So they brought me over and they introduced me to this guy and said, you know, Walter Cronkite, this is Leo Enright. I shook his hand very warmly. And I said to him, Mr. Cronkite, I'm delighted to meet you. What do you do? Now, you have to understand that I was a kid from Ireland. We didn't have American television. I mean, okay, we had Rin Tin Tin and Lassie, but we didn't watch American TV news. I had never heard of Walter Cronkite. I mean, I knew Patrick Moore, of course, because we got BBC. I knew James Burke. Both Patrick and James went on to become very dear friends. And James is very much still with us. So I knew the big people in my life were Kevin O'Kelly in RTE. Kevin was the legendary RTE commentator on the Moonshots, and Patrick and James. Those, you know, they were my mates. But this guy Cronkite, I'd never heard of, and Cronkite had two heavies on either side of him. And these guys, I mean, it was really bizarre. They clearly decided that anyone who asked Walter Cronkite what did he do for a living was clearly barmy. So the two of them literally lifted me up by my arms and walked me out of the Time Life party and threw me out the door.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Obviously, that wasn't the end of your career that involves the space side of things, and you've kept the space up. I know you say you covered wars and everything, but obviously for space boffins, it's probably another entire program we could do just on that alternate side of your career. But what for you has been the most memorable, or either meeting somebody from the space industry or maybe a broadcast, what for you is the one that you still look back at and think, wow, I met X, or I was there when?
Oh, I think unquestionably, Sue, it would be Voyager. I mean, it's simply, you know, I look back across my career, and of course, you know, Voyager dominated, you know, the entire, you know, fourth quarter of the 20th century. It was just the most amazing scientific endeavor that I've ever covered. And I was very fortunate to have been at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for every single flyby of the Voyager series. So without a shadow of a doubt, it would be Voyager. And, you know, when it comes to meeting people, can I be absolutely blunt with you?
Yeah.
I'm not a space fan. You know, I'm not a fanboy. You know, I meet these people, I interview them. You know, my job is to hold these people to account. They're spending the taxpayers' money. And so I don't look at these people in awe. Look, I do admire and respect what they do. Absolutely. There's no question about that. But I've never looked for a selfie with an astronaut. You know, it's just not my thing. I believe that my job is to be objective. And, you know, the moment journalists drop the objectivity, we're in danger. And we've done it, I admit myself, I have done it on a number of occasions where we have fanboyed and fangirled projects which we should have been screaming from the rooftops about their failings. And this is really a big bugbear of mine that, you know, I'm not a fanboy. I admire these people. And if you were to ask, you know, if I was pushed as to, you know, who are the most interesting people that I've interviewed, unquestionably the planetary scientists.
Yeah.
I mean, every single woman and man among them that I have met have been fantastic individuals, hugely dedicated, and most of them love a pint.
Yeah, I must admit, I agree with you about the more interesting people are often the ones who work behind the scene. And I'm just wondering whether I should delete all my selfies with Tim Peake.
Yeah, but that verges on the sinister, yeah, sometimes. I think you raise a really interesting point, because I think we tread a very fine line. And I liken it to sports journalism, where the sports journalists, and they call themselves journalists, are often very pro a particular club, and overtly will talk, you know, on the BBC, that you'll hear presenters talk about their club, and that's not in any way objective. And I know, you know, we're definitely guilty of being space fans while covering it, and it's a very difficult line to tread.
But Leo's right, though. At the same time, I, like you, will always try to be objective. And I do remember working on Newsnight for the BBC, and doing a piece on what was then, I think, the British National Space Agency. I'm not sure they had become the UK Space Agency just yet. And it was critical about the selection of a particular mission. And I saw it as a sort of mark of I've done my job right, when the people who, you know, give me lots of interviews, have gave me great access all the time, I suddenly heard one of them say, "Where the hell is Sue Nelson? Where did you see that?" And they were furious, absolutely furious. And I thought, well, yeah, I'm not your PR person. I've still got to say the things that you might find uncomfortable.
Do you think it's harder now to do that, to be objective, Leo? I'm thinking of a piece that I wrote the last couple of years and a radio program I made for BBC Future, which questioned the need for astronauts. And the flack I got.
Yes.
Flack I got. I mean, I've written 3,000 pieces about how wonderful space is and how wonderful astronauts are. I'll write one piece that's got some criticism. And actually, I was just reporting. It wasn't me. It wasn't my voice. It's for the BBC. You can't do that. Do you think it's harder now and you've got to be a bit more robust? You've got to have that armor to be able to say, look, we are objective. We are just reporting the news.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing that I find interesting is that, a lot of the quote-unquote competition out there, the people that are being interviewed on mainstream, high audience programs, I find that, much more frequently now I'm competing against people that I would class as fanboys or fangirls. They often get on when I feel like I could have contributed more. Now, that does sound a little bit, arrogant. But, I listen to these people and they're so excited. Yes, that's great. But, they don't mention all, other things like, the thing went over budget or, stuff like that. And also, I mean, I sometimes get quite annoyed with colleagues in the BBC as much as anywhere else, who ring me up. Now, take an example. The World Service rang me there some years ago and said, Leo, would you come on and do a phone in? One of these World Service global phone-ins about medical experiments in space on animals. And I said, sure, of course, yeah, I'll do that. So the other person on the show was from PETA, the animal rights campaign group. And the PETA person, there was steam coming out of her ears talking about the biosat experiments that were flown by the Europeans and the Americans aboard Russian spacecraft because they couldn't get clearance to do the same missions themselves. And the producer was ballistic afterwards because I agreed with the PETA person. They were absolutely right. It was a complete and utter disgrace that they were sticking probes into the brains of primates and flying them into space. So, sometimes our own colleagues misunderstand us and think that in a way we're kind of fans. But your point, Richard, was exactly right. I always think of myself like a sports reporter. If I was a sports reporter, I would be reporting on doping. So, I would expect equally when I'm doing space, they won't be doping, but there's a lot I can do that needs to be done.
I want to ask you some questions about Ireland in space. But for that, I just think that as well on the history, we ought to just mention Skylab, because Skylab for me was the sort of moment when I really got into human spaceflight and reporting human spaceflight. And then, you just see those, I can remember on Blue Peter, those extraordinary pictures of the astronauts floating in this enormous space. And now it's 50 years since Skylab, which again makes me feel very old, but that was almost a turning point, wasn't it? I think Skylab, from the race to the moon to actually we can move into space, we can as humans operate in space, live in space, and start to use space.
Yeah, I think Skylab, I vividly remember it, and as you say, it does kind of date us. I did find it very difficult to get news stories on about Skylab. Obviously, Skylab 2, We Fix Anything, that was a big story when they had to rescue the space station and this extraordinary umbrella that they built. They literally, there was a woman seamstress whose name actually is up at the moment around on social media, and there are pictures of her sewing this thing together in a building in Houston across the road from the Manned Spacecraft Center. But I found it very difficult to get stuff on because it was a bit geeky, quote unquote. But my God, when Skylab re-entered, I was leading bulletins for 3-4 weeks. It was just insane. And it was the early days of kind of global communications where we could actually get pictures from Australia. We could, you know, and I could get information in a timely way about reentry windows and stuff like that. So we were able to give a blow-by-blow account of the reentry of Skylab in a way that we couldn't cover stuff almost, you know, before that.
That's an interesting point, though, there about how you couldn't get coverage for what has got to go down in history as one of the most dramatic rescue missions of all time, with some crazy stuff going on in space. And yet when there's a tiny chance of a little bit of a spacecraft hitting someone on Earth, it becomes this major news story. And that's all people remember. A lot of people remember Skylab for.
Yeah, I mean, talk to Mike Fole about it. You know, I mean, he made his name by nearly getting killed aboard the Russian space station when a Progress vehicle collided with it. You know, that's, you know, true. I guess it will always be thus. It's a bit like, you know, the White House press corps when they follow the president around. You have no idea, guys, no idea how seething and angry the White House press corps were being dragged to Ireland this year with Joe Biden. They hated every minute of it because there was no news. But they were forced to sit through every single Irish, you know, Camalia event, you know, kiss the Blarney Stone. They had to sit through it just in case someone took a pot shot at Joe Biden. And unfortunately, for the same reason, I have to watch every single spacecraft launch just in case.
Mm. Yeah. I'm just going to mention the woman you were referring to who was sewing and helped do a crucial repair to the Skylab shield was Eileen Baker. And I know this because I made a radio doc about the women seamstresses, mostly predominantly women, called yes. Hey Sister, Sew Sisters.
Wonderful.
And she's no longer with us, but her son, Herb Baker, who worked at NASA and still does so much space-related work and continues to do so. He came on the program to talk about the work that his mother had done. So if you're listening, Herb, it's nice to hear a reference to your mum again.
Lovely.
Let's just talk then about Ireland in space, because you've just written a piece in a Space Chronicle magazine, which is one of the British Interplanetary Society magazines, about Ireland in space. You say that it's a history that often gets forgotten, but I quite like this, that Ireland could claim to be the first nation, even before Ireland existed as a nation, in astronomy with these Neolithic discoveries.
Oh, yes. I mean, Newgrange, which is the ancient burial site on the banks of the River Boyne, is an extraordinary place. It is just the most amazing monument. It's 500 years older than the Great Pyramids of Giza. This thing is very, very ancient. It's 1,000 years older than the blue stones, the famous big stones at Stonehenge. This thing was produced by an ancient civilization that we know virtually nothing about. We don't know their language. We don't really know their beliefs. But we do know, at least there is quite good authority. I'm being a little bit cautious here because the story of the light box at Newgrange, which is well reported and quite good authority to support, that this light box, which lets in light at the winter solstice, the sun shines down the passage of this tomb at Newgrange. It was designed 5,500 years ago by the first farmers in Ireland. The first people to farm in Ireland had just arrived in the country, and they built this, it is postulated, so that they would know the seasons. And so I maintain that the Irish Neolithic builders were, in fact, Europe's first astronomers.
And now Ireland's about to launch its first satellite this year. Is it a bit late into the space? You know, it's had 5,500 years to get a satellite up. Is it catching up with what the rest of Europe? I mean, Ireland's long been a member of the European Space Agency, but is this a sort of catch up now with the satellite industry?
Well, not exactly, Richard. The way I would answer this as a true Irishman is that, you know, Europe caught up with Ireland in the 20th century. You know, we're really only just, you know, it's kind of, you know, hopping forwards and back, as it were. Ireland was mission control for the world's exploration of the cosmos for most of the Victorian era. The huge telescope at Birr in County Offaly, I mean, literally in the middle of a bog, this guy built a huge telescope. It was the biggest telescope in the world for 50 years in the 1800s. And astronomers flocked there from around the world to explore the universe. It was overtaken, obviously, at the end of the 1800s by bigger telescopes. But, you know, it is truly the grandmother or the grandfather of the Webb telescope, the Leviathan of Parsonstown, as it's called. Parsonstown was the old Victorian name for Birr. But, yes, we've had a quiet period. you know, we're kind of picking up now. The first Irish experiment in space was back in the early 1960s. An Irish experiment was launched aboard an American spy satellite, one of the Corona series. The Corona satellites, they were described as science research satellites, but of course they weren't.
They were film cameras in space, weren't they?
Exactly. They were spy satellites. And these cameras were, the film from the cameras was returned from the satellite by parachute. And the Irish experiment was inside one of these capsules that came back. It was a cosmic ray detector. And the experiment arrived back in Dublin, and they rang the space people in America and said, "Please, sir, could you tell us, sir, what was the thickness of the wall of the capsule that our experiment was in? Because we can't analyze it unless we know the thickness." And the American said, "Well, sir, I'd have to shoot you if I told you." So the first Irish experiment in space didn't work out so well. But they went on to land a similar instrument on the surface of the moon on Apollo 16. And the LDEF, the Long Duration Exposure Facility, which was one of the biggest, I think the second biggest formally experiment ever flown on the space shuttle, was actually mostly Irish. It was a huge cosmic ray detector for the detection of heavy cosmic rays coming from galaxies. I call them messengers from distant galaxies.
Lovely. And of course, there's been Irish involvement with missions like SOHO and...
A lot of ESA missions. It's a long list. I did do some research.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good. and at the moment, you're speaking to us from Darmstadt in Germany for a specific reason relating to Mars Express.
So this is Darmstadt's the European Mission Control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. After JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, I would have to say that my favorite space center is ESOC, as we call it, the European Space Operations Center here in Darmstadt. I've hugely fond memories of spending time here at many's a mission over the decades. And it's lovely to come back to look back over with old friends, to look back over 20 years of Mars Express. It launched in May of whatever 20 years ago was, 2003. I'm not good at math. It launched in 2003. It actually arrived at Mars on Christmas Day, 2003. And a lot of people from that mission are going to be here today. And I'm really, really looking forward to catching up, because Mars Express exceeded our expectations. It's been a huge success, and all credit to everybody involved, but particularly, I have to say, the imaging people. They really did a fantastic job of presenting us with amazing pictures of the Martian surface from orbit. But some of the science experiments too have been really exciting.
Yeah, so now I'm feeling old because
you were there.
I was there as well, I think, for that and reported for the BBC.
Oh, I think you were at the Royal Society in London.
For
the landing for Beagle.
It's amazing, isn't it, when you... you sort of judge your life and it's looking through photographs and you suddenly think, oh, yes, I was here. Oh, yes, I saw that. Oh, yes, I remember that when it first came out. But it's a nice feeling, isn't it? And I know you keep saying, you know, I'm not a space fan. But the fact that you've kept doing space means in some way that it obviously holds a strong area of interest in your heart, shall we say.
Yeah, I think so. Richard mentioned Beagle, the British lander.
Lander that was attached to Mars Express, yeah.
Exactly, yes. And can I be honest and tell you about what I think was my worst judgment call ever?
Of course.
Oh, yeah, great.
when Mars Express went into orbit, at the same time they released Beagle, the Beagle lander. And a lot of people here, I'll be honest with you, you know, sotto voce, a lot of people here at ESOC would have said to me at the time, it's just it's make weight. We needed ballast. And so, you know, we let the Brits put this little thing on the side of the spacecraft. And to be honest, I bought a lot of that vibe. And so I'll be completely honest with you. I decided... the BBC asked me to go to ESOP for the Beagle landing, and I took my holidays. I decided that I didn't want to be associated with something that was definitely, I felt, going to fail. And so I sat with my Christmas pudding and watched some of my colleagues reporting on this failure and all looking glum. And thought to myself, oh my, wasn't I smart? However, screen goes wavy and images emerge in the not so distant past of Beagle on the surface of Mars and within an ace of actually succeeding. It did not fail. It didn't crash and burn. It successfully landed on the surface of Mars, and the only thing that failed was a solar panel that didn't open.
I know, it's so frustrating.
Really, you know, I feel I'm quite ashamed of myself because I really did like Colin Pillinger.
And that's the chief scientist on that.
I really liked Colin Pillinger.
I think we all did.
Yeah, you couldn't not like him. Yeah.
With him. But I just, you know, I was convinced that this was a quixotic adventure, and I was so wrong. So my apologies to Colin if he's watching from some distant galaxy.
Oh, it's funny you should say that, because obviously the late Colin Pillinger, I'm just going to reach across the desk because I found, and I'm holding in my hand, I might put it up on Twitter and Facebook. I just was clearing out things and found a postcard, and it's of Colin on a sledge. I'm not sure who he's being pushed by, and he's in the most wonderful sort of Scandinavian style woolly hat and sweater, brilliantly patterned, and he signed it. I don't know how I got it. Maybe he just sent it to me with his book or something. I don't know.
It's an odd picture.
Have Colin Pillinger right in front of me right now.
Yeah, there's a little sidebar to that story, because I think I probably covered the anniversary 10 years ago, it would have been. And I asked one of the engineers, was working then at what was then called Airbus, about any regrets about Beagle. He said his one regret was putting the radio antenna beneath the solar panel rather than on the outside, because if it had been on the outside, we almost certainly would have got pictures back. So there are probably pictures of the Mars surface in the lander. It's just that last panel that failed to deploy, so we never got any signal back to Earth.
Right. So for you, Leo, for the foreseeable future, you're just going to keep on covering those missions for us?
Oh, yeah, I hope so. You know, as long as the gods allow me, I certainly do intend. I mean, you will gather from, you know, I think people listening will gather from the entire conversation, since we've kind of glossed over the human spaceflight side of this, where my passions lie. And, you know, really, I am looking forward to some of the outstanding missions that are currently en route. You know, I certainly hope to live long enough to be able to report, for instance, on the worst named European mission in the history of European missions.
JUICE.
The JUICE mission. Its arrival on Jupiter and the Irish involvement in that. We've got an involvement on the radio science instruments. And also, you know, these moons of Jupiter, really another Irish connection, of course, because we only know about the oceans beneath the surface of these icy moons because of Connemara chaos, which Randy Tufts, who was the one of the scientists working on the original missions, spotted these things that he identified correctly as icebergs frozen into the landscape of Europa. And of course, icebergs only float on oceans. And so that was really the first indication we had of oceans at Jupiter and subsequently at Saturn. And they named that discovery site, the site that kind of led the way to these ideas, they named it Connemara because it looked like Connemara marble.
Oh, gosh. And what about the Artemis missions? Are you looking forward to them, or do you feel very much a sort of, well, I was there when it all happened first time round?
Well, no, I definitely do not kind of feel a sense that the best is behind us. I have a very strong feeling that ultimately the Artemis program and the other programs that are being proposed for humans back to the moon and then on to Mars will happen, and they will be extraordinary when they do, not least because, you know, the polar missions are going to be just extraordinary. My only worry as a TV is, I mean, my heart is in radio, but I do TV as well. My only worry is the pictures from that part of the moon. I'm rather worried that the pictures are not going to be great because of the sun angles. What is largely overlooked in all the talk about this, and often not properly captured in the artist's impressions, is the extreme sun angles that astronauts are going to be working with. They will literally have to have headlights on their spacesuits so that they can see in case they trip over something because of the shadows, the long shadows that will be obscuring their view of the ground.
I have a fear now that those long shadows will just promote a second round of conspiracy theories in terms of the Hollywood lighting or something like that. But we'll deal with that when it happens.
Hollywood would light it better.
Yeah, would light it better, yeah. Well, Leo Enright, thank you so much for joining us. There's so much more we could probably talk to you about, but it's been lovely to just get a brief glimpse into your continuing extraordinary career.
I think distinguished
space
was the right word.
I think distinguished definitely right. Thanks.
Well,
Ian.
It was lovely to talk to such distinguished colleagues.
Oh. Now you've degraded that line. But thank you, Leo.
This is Space Boffins. Do get in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter, email podcast@spaceboffins.com, Or you could write us a letter.
Really?
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? Be right. Lovely to get a letter.
But we're not giving them an address. Well, if you snail look at, mail
yeah,
address.
It's on the Boffin Media website.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't realise that.
Yeah. Boffinmedia.com, boffinmedia.co.uk for all your podcast and radio needs videos.
And what if they use a stamp within the UK that's got the Queen's head on and no barcode?
Ah.
We've got until July, haven't
yes,
you,
that's right.
You can
do that.
You know, yeah. Actually, I've not seen her. I've not. Have the stamps with Charles' head come out yet?
No, we've got ones with the Queen's head and the barcode.
And a barcode. Yeah. And so eventually there'll be a transitioning period to King's head and a barcode. Yeah. Will anybody still be sending post with stamps on?
Send us a letter. That would be so lovely.
I love letters.
I would dedicate 5 minutes of the podcast to that letter if we had a letter.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I'm somebody who still writes thank you cards and sends them.
I think it's a civilized way of doing it.
Yeah. I do, and still sends Christmas cards instead of an email or one of those jingles. I'd much rather have that. Anyway, if you listened to last month's podcast, apart from NASA's new head of science, Dr. Nicola Fox, we also heard from two ESA astronauts. There was the new recruit, Pablo Alvarez, and the more seasoned Alexander Gerst, who will also be helping the latest additions with their training.
So I'm going to still be an active astronaut in the European Astronaut Corps, but at the same time, between missions, what we astronauts typically do is we use our experience that we gained in space to help out other programs or to help out colleagues. Like in my case, I'm going to be the lead of the astronaut operations team at the European Astronaut Center, and that means I'm going to work with our new colleagues, the new astronauts that will join ESA to start basic training.
That was Alexander. Now, I gathered those interviews during a trip to Bremen in Germany when there were three European service modules for the Artemis missions in a clean room at the same time. And we promised you some more interviews from there. So let's begin with someone who has a vested interest in what Pablo, Alexander and all the other ESA astronauts are training for alongside the ISS missions. It's David Parker, ESA's Director of Human and Robotic Exploration, and I began by asking him if there'd been a different selection process with the new cohort of astronauts, knowing that at least one of them could perhaps also be going to the moon.
Well, most of the selection process has been pretty similar to what was planned. We had a good idea we'd get a lot more applications, so actually just having enough people to process and then interview and do all of the selection procedures was a bit more complicated. But yes, of course, in this group of people, it was a higher probability that some of them will one day fly to the moon, work on the moon, maybe even go to Mars. It's also going to be true that for these astronauts, their first flights will definitely be to the ISS, and our gateway missions are likely to be assigned to the current group of astronauts, the ones who were selected in 2009.
And in terms of the success of Artemis 1, have there been any aspects of that where you've either had to tweak any ideas in terms of, you know, what you're planning?
Well, the thing about Artemis 1, it was absolutely a test flight, a bit like test flying a new aircraft. You push, as they say, the envelope. You push the limits of the flight characteristics, the way of operating it, not because you necessarily plan to do that with the astronauts, but because you want to have the margins of comfort and safety regarding the performance. It was good to see that the power generation was above predictions, and the propulsion system, which is, as a propulsion engineer myself, incredibly complicated and sophisticated to give the safety for astronauts, worked really, really well. There are always snags. You don't expect everything to work perfectly. So there's a particular snag which has been identified relating to the way the power conditioning unit is connected to some of the valves. So we got inadvertent operating of certain valves, but then we just command them shut again. So we need to get to the bottom of what that was about.
How serious is that?
I don't think I view it as very serious, because if it had happened in an actual mission, very simply a red light would have gone on and somebody would have pressed a button to close a valve again. It could well be some sort of electromagnetic interference. So this is the thing where you have a lot of different electronic devices and cablings in the same area, and sometimes you with small, very small signals, one device can interfere with another. So it's all on the test rig now, on the test bench, starting to investigate that.
On the safety aspect for astronauts, you know, one lesson that was learned from the Apollo missions was Apollo 13, in terms of engineering ingenuity and finding solutions to problems that you hadn't necessarily expected would happen. Are there any redundancies where astronauts could shelter or to, you know, if any way, whether it's micrometeorites or whether there's a, you know, a more serious problem?
The vehicle, as I said, has a great deal of redundancy, particularly in the propulsion system. So what do I mean? It means there are two sets of thrusters. There are often four sets of valves, so the possibility to cross-strap between different sides of the propulsion system. So if one device stops working, there are multiple other ways of making sure the propulsion system keeps working, because that's the most fundamental thing to get us home safely. But yes, absolutely, there will be operational ways of orienting the spacecraft to give higher protection in the event of a suspected meteorite risk, or particularly with respect to radiation considerations. The solar arrays are very nearly twice as much as required to generate the power required to support the crew. And of course, what we didn't have on Artemis 1 that we will obviously have on Artemis 2 is actually the water and gas tanks to support the astronauts themselves.
And in terms of this sort of duality of, in terms of your job, sort of robotic and human spaceflight, they're often seen as sort of contradictory in terms of one might, you know, outmaneuver the other. Do you see this very much as a partnership and a continued partnership?
Yeah, I always say that human-robotic exploration are absolutely synergistic. It's the same thing when somebody tries to tell you that Moon is more interesting than Mars and Mars is more interesting than Moon. No, I don't think that's true at all. The reason for doing exploration is eventually to get humans to that destination and to use it for science or technology, or, as we are moving with low Earth orbit, a place for business. There will be commercial space stations, commercial research, obviously commercial tourists going into space. We're a long way from that with the Moon. But if we want to, for example, drill 100 meters down to find the paleoregoliths, ancient material from the impact of the predecessor of the Moon with the Earth that might be buried deep down on the surface of the Moon, we're not going to have a drilling rig that's going to be assembled by robots anytime soon.
The training, which part of it do you think is potentially going to be the most useful for those who may find themselves on the lunar surface?
Well, in a sense, we've been starting to prepare our ESA astronauts and indeed international astronauts for lunar exploration for quite a while. So we have this program called Pangaea, where we are teaching astronauts how to be geologists, how to go into unfamiliar environments and find the interesting rocks, the material they need to get the right samples. We're also thinking about how to extract material from the Moon to use in material generation. So some of our explorers are in the labs, but they're starting to pass on their knowledge to the astronauts themselves.
And Antarctica plays a role in this as well.
Well, I always use this comparison of Antarctica being the nearest to a moon base as we have now. There was a race to the South Pole more than 100 years ago. It was 50 years before we really went back there and started building Antarctic bases. So we developed technology, recycling technologies, life support system technologies, and we demonstrate those in Antarctic bases. But we also send a physician there every season to the Concordia base to work on some of the psychological aspects of being isolated, long-duration spaceflight. Antarctica is a good analogue of that.
When you have an astronaut corps of incredibly talented, incredibly smart people, very ambitious too, how do you manage expectations in terms of, I'm sorry, folks, but some of you aren't going to get to the moon?
This is absolutely true. And actually, it's part of the selection process is actually challenge them with a question. Supposing you are recruited into the European Space Agency and you may wait 7 years before you fly, or you may never fly at all. Are you sure you really want to do this? And so it's absolutely managing the expectations. But it doesn't mean that the astronauts are sitting around doing nothing between the missions. Far from it. They are managing the training. They're doing astronaut work. They're sitting in the control room in Houston, relaying messages up to the space station and back again. Some of them are supporting the development of the Lunar Gateway and then on lunar surface habitats. So they're all kept very, very busy between missions. For Artemis 3, there would be four astronauts, of which two would go down to the surface of the moon. So we don't expect to be on the first Artemis mission. We have agreed with NASA that there will be three ESA astronauts flying on Orion to the Lunar Gateway to live and work there. And so we expect them to be supporting the assembly of the gateway. That'll be Artemis 4, Artemis 5 flight. The third mission, TBD at the moment, to be decided. But yes, it's absolutely our ambition to get European boots on the moon by the end of this decade.
In terms of the first woman being back on the moon, obviously it won't be a European, but how do you feel about that?
That's really exciting. And for us, diversity in the astronaut corps is something of great importance. We have diversity because of our different nationalities in the European Space Agency. But something that's been really important for me is also to pioneer the para-astronaut feasibility project. We have the ambition for ESA to have the first astronaut with a disability. And we've selected in John McFaul an amazing candidate that we're going to be working with over the next few years.
ESA's Director of Human and Robotic Exploration, the ever delightful David Parker. And we will endeavour to get an interview with John McFaul. You probably saw pictures of him in the vomit comet. It's not really called that, is it? It's called the zero-G.
Zero-gravity. I mean, the plane, they do call it the zero-G plane, as you know, because... Oh, did I mention I went up on it once? But technically speaking, it's... mind you, you are in microgravity in the...
it's a simulation of microgravity.
It's a simulation of microgravity.
I mean, a zero-G plane would be awesome, wouldn't it?
Yes. I enjoyed that one it was. I'm not sure you would have done because
I think you
might have been sick.
No, I'm not normally sick.
Because you don't like funfair rides.
Not sick, just terrified.
Oh, okay. I actually think it would have been both. Sick and terrified.
No, I rarely get sick. I don't get motion sickness. I'd be fine in space. I just would hate it.
Right. I would just like to mention to any long-time listeners to this podcast, you will remember and know what I'm talking about. The centrifuge interview when Rich and I both went on the UK's oldest. I think actually it might be even the world's oldest centrifuge, wasn't it?
Working centrifuge.
Yeah. Working centrifuge. When we went on that, you've got to go back in the archives to find that if you've not heard that, because Richard on that centrifuge was hysterically funny. It was basically, think of the Doppler effect with instead of a sort of ambulance going, wah, 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 although that was a sound probably from 1975 of an ambulance, it's more like Richard going,
what, was it hilarious?
Go, it
was. Was it hilarious?
It was for me. Sorry. Oh my God. Just thinking about it. Anyway, but oh gosh.
You finished.
It's
clearly the funniest thing. Yeah.
Well, you were supposed to do commentary because I've done all my. I'm
commentary.
Going up to 3.6G. Yeah. Oh no, I can't. Yeah. I can't lift my hands. And you are, to be fair, you are much better at doing commentary than I am, which is why you often do it for space launches. But your commentary just consisted.
I'm
of
fine
scream.
Of commentating on other people doing terrifying things is fine, but I'm not doing it.
Oh dear. Oh gosh. I might just get that. You know, if ever I feel a bit low, I think I should just get that on play. Anyway, so our next interview from Bremen is with NASA's Bill Hartwell, who's the Orion program representative at ESA in the Netherlands. And what's especially interesting about this interview, in my opinion, is when we touch upon Russia. But he began, anyway, by explaining about the main lessons that had been learnt from the successful launch of Artemis 1.
Obviously, the rocket was very successful. They have reviewing the data and the performance of the rocket. But on the Orion, we put the spacecraft through its paces. And when I say that, it's like a test that your teacher is giving you. You have a specific set of things that you intend to test. And we completed all of those. And the nice part about it was the teacher said, okay, well, we've got that part. How about I also test you on these things? And so we were able to expand the envelope, which gives us a lot of confidence. Confidence that the spacecraft is more capable than what is designed for. And that also allows us to expand our capabilities on missions as we go forward.
Now, expanding that envelope, let's get into the detail there.
Sure.
What things were there that, you know, you realized as a team that, oh, this is better than expected?
Sure. Well, there's some real fundamental ones. The power generation is we have more power than we were expecting. What that enables us, we have a new mission on Artemis 4 for Orion. This is a new function that Orion must be a tugboat to deliver gateway elements, modules, from the joint launch of the Orion, also what we call them co-manifested payloads. So the International Habitation Module is one on Artemis 4. It's heavy from our perspective in that we are designed to carry 10 metric tons to the gateway and to dock it. So imagine that you are driving a vehicle yourself and you have to take it somewhere. But then imagine that then someone says, okay, well, let's put this 10 metric ton thing on the front of you, and now you have to drive it to where you're trying to go. This takes control authority, and it also takes power for keeping the spacecraft warm. And the spacecraft on the front, the module that we will be carrying, the International Habitation Module, will be in the shade most of the time. And so it requires power to stay warm. And so we have to provide power to this module. And now we know we have more power than we were expecting. And this is a good thing for the overall mission.
You, in your previous job, you were working with a number of countries by being program manager with the International Space Station.
Yeah.
How does this mission, this series of mission, compare to the ISS? Is it easier or is it more difficult in other ways, particularly with the political situation that's ongoing, be it Russia or China?
Yeah. Well, my experience is working on the International Space Station program, as you said. Largely, my experience has been working with the Russian partners. I was a student in Moscow at the Moscow Aviation Institute. And I arrived at the Johnson Space Center right at about the same time that we were had just committed to building the International Space Station with the Russians. And so for 20 more years, I've been leading projects with cooperating with Russia. Many of our projects, I would say, integrate. How closely are you integrating depends on the arrangement of who is doing what. And much of what we've done on International Space Station, I would say, is integration where the interface is fairly clear and defined and specific. It's not intertwined. What we have done with the European Space Agency and Airbus and with our prime contractor, Lockheed Martin, is a much, much more intertwined integration than I have ever experienced in my career. It's much more difficult. And we've been successful. This is what's really, I think, is the achievement that we have made at this point.
Why was it more difficult?
Well, imagine that you and I were going to go climb a mountain, and I was going to build a car, and I said, would you please build me a trailer? Okay, so we need to talk about how we're going to connect the trailer to my car that I'm building. And that's the kind of integration we've done for much of the International Space Station. We have different modules that connect. Well, in this scenario with the European Space Agency, NASA said, can you please build us the engine and transmission for our car that we are going to take to climb this mountain? So the level of detail that you must go to it's just much, much more complex.
It's also a question of trust, of course. And would you say that ESA gained your trust because of its automatic transfer vehicle, which the European service module is based upon, in that you know it's worked?
Yes. So this is the first time that NASA has ever entrusted a core element of our flagship spacecraft, human-rated spacecraft, to an international partner. You don't make a commitment to a partnership like that lightly. The decades of cooperation between NASA and the European Space Agency is at the foundation. The expertise, obviously, in the automated transfer vehicle, delivering cargo in a very extremely accurate, the technologies that ESA developed and implemented on the automated transfer vehicle were spot on and very high caliber. So yes, we built trust. The foundation is there from many, many cooperative efforts. The automated transfer vehicle is certainly an important element of that trust.
One aspect that many, particularly of a sort of younger generation, are quite shocked to hear is that, you know, 3 years after man landed on the moon, that the program was cancelled. Does that thought ever cross your mind for this, that actually there's huge support? Well, in some cases, people do question why return, but people sort of understand that it's part of human exploration, but political leaders change. Are you sort of budget-proof for what you've got in mind?
I think we have a very solid program and a solid footing politically, certainly within the United States. We've benefited and enjoyed bipartisan support within the U.S. Congress for many decades, and that we don't see changing. Our budgets are not like the Apollo program, which were extremely sharp increases and therefore, in some respects, not sustainable. So our objective is, and so far our success has been, to have a sustainable budget that we can continue to build the partnership, pull in partners to afford other things so that we're not trying to afford all of it ourselves, and also reach out to get the best in that the commercial partners can provide as well.
You know, many people think of trips to the moon, not just its success in terms of landing on the moon, but even success from things that didn't go quite as planned. Is Orion prepared for whatever may happen? Are there redundancies to keep those astronauts safe?
This is a core to what we're doing, right? We've already been to the moon. We went to the moon in the 60s and 70s, and the Apollo capsule looks very much like the Orion capsule. They're capsules. In 1969, we had automobiles, and they also look very much like automobiles we have today. They have four wheels, they have a steering wheel, a windshield, whichever country you come from, perhaps a trunk or a boot. And we have those same things today in automobiles. But the underlying technologies in the Orion spacecraft contribute massively to the safety and the reliability of getting to the moon and back. Just as if you were driving in a car from 1969 and veered off the road and hit a tree, the chance that you would walk away from that was much lower than if you should crash in a car from the 2020s. The technology, the safety, it's all part of what the Orion is all about doing, going back to the moon in a safe and reliable way.
Why should we return to the moon?
Obviously, you can get many different answers. On one end of the spectrum, you have the technology that we invest in can be applied here on Earth. And so the jobs, the technical training, the inspiration that it provides for students to learn the science, the math, these things are it's contagious. Space, something about space really, really inspires. And so to inspire those to bring technical capabilities to our problems that we have here on Earth. And then you have on the far end of the spectrum, you have people that feel that humans need to be a more than one planet species for the long term. And I think it depends on your personality where you fall on the spectrum, but it's quite compelling to go to the moon, especially since we're doing it not to go to the moon, but to go to Mars.
And personally, considering that you have, you know, lived in Russia,
yeah,
you must be disappointed about the way things have gone.
Sure. Yeah, I think I have bookended the very special time that we had cooperating deeply with the Russians. And on a personal note, I have still friends in Russia. And so, yes, it's a sad time to see that cooperation and the opportunity for future cooperation to those doors a bit closing now.
But they still remain open?
There are people who, when I came to NASA in 1993, who were completely surprised that we were cooperating with the Russians. They said, I don't understand how I can be cooperating with these people. I've been pointing missiles at them my entire career. So, yes, there's still possibility. I would think we have another decade before there will be new programs started with Russia.
NASA's Orion program representative based at ESA in the Netherlands, Bill Hartwell.
I do find it weird that we are still cooperating with the Russians, the West, with the Russians on the International Space Station. I find it extraordinary when we're essentially at war with them.
It's
all very well saying cooperating in space and all the rest of it, but I do have an issue with it.
It is difficult because, let's face it, if it hadn't been for the Russians over the last few decades, who knows where we'd be with the space program, and particularly with this.
There wouldn't be a space station.
No, exactly. So you've got to sort of give that credit. And also, it's like, I know it's incredibly difficult, but those astronauts aren't there as working members of the military, although I know, like over here, ESA astronauts, a lot of them are ex-military. I think keeping the politics out of it is a good thing for space. But whether that's going to continue, I think is. And I liked the way Bill Hartwell, obviously, you know, it's professional and personal to him. And when somebody's lived in Russia and knows Russians, you don't think of it in such black and white, you know, they're the bad guys, we're the good guys. Because there are people, as we know, with Ukraine, there are people living in Russia who are anti-war. And, you know, you've got to accept that what the government does doesn't represent the entire will of the people. And I understand your point of view, but I'm also glad that they are involved, because I think once they're out, that will be really hard to come back from. Really hard.
I mean, you know, I've obviously written quite a lot on the Soviet space program, the Russian space program. I was a regular. I used to go to Moscow every year to commentate on launches. I'm a big advocate, you know, for what they've done. And, you know, the International Space Station, the programs I've made over the years, podcasts,
You've
all the rest of it.
Almost forgot to mention the most hard-hitting one, which was Space Dogs.
Yes, the Space Dogs book. I've written about Space Dogs. But, you know, frankly, with the space station, we wouldn't have a space station if it wasn't for the Russians. They saved the program because they knew how to build space stations. They had all this expertise in space station. Nevertheless, the situation now with the space station, I think is untenable. Mm. I absolutely think that got to separate. I don't understand how we can be cooperating.
But we're already effectively we are separate to China.
even though there's
been a war with China.
There's been ESA and Chinese cooperation, but a lot of those projects are sort of going in different directions.
I think it's
do you really want a world where there's China doing its thing, Russia doing its thing, America doing its thing, ESA, Europe doing its thing, and the Middle East, of course, with all their quite successful space programs, and you've got Africa starting to come in.
But I think it's Orwellian because I think we're holding contradictory positions. On one hand, we're saying Russia are the bad guys, we need to support Ukraine. On the other hand, we're saying, oh, we'll cooperate in space because space is different. Space isn't different.
Space is an extension
of the Earth.
I would prefer the Earth is a multinational, multicultural, multilingual place, and I would prefer space to reflect that.
Discuss. Your thoughts welcome. If you've got any thoughts on this on social media, or, as I say, write us a letter. That would be so lovely. So if you wrote us a letter. This has been Space Boffins. I say, do get in touch and...
see you again next month.
See you again next month. Yeah. Or the month after.
Who knows? Five weeks, six weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
We're doing our best. Honestly, we've had all sorts going on this end, haven't we? So,
yeah. We'll attempt to get back on track with a monthly Space Boffins podcast. Thank you for your support and thanks for listening.